Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Maureen Berry and Kit Laurie will tell us all about a new project underway, a new co-op brew pub in Dayton. We'll also hear from a couple of young men who want to spread the word about a project of theirs, one that will help children half a world away. And later in the program, we'll hear the first of several selections this month from the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize. Up first, a Special Wish Foundation is celebrating their 29th anniversary, providing wishes to terminally ill children in the Miami Valley. David Sire is the executive director, and I was pleased to speak with him this week about their efforts.
Special Wish Foundation, we are the only wish granting organization located in the Dayton region. We cover a 6-county region plus any child that is treated at Dayton Children's Medical Center. A Special Wish Foundation, we are celebrating our 29th year. We were founded in 1983 by a local police officer, David Lance, who had read an article about a child in Columbus who was diagnosed with cancer and was receiving his wish to go to Disney and meet Mickey Mouse. David was moved by that, contacted a Special Wish National Headquarters, which is located in Columbus, and said, "Hey, I want to do this. How can I make it happen?" And they said, "Well, the easiest way is to open up your own chapter." And so Mr. Lance partnered with Bill Elan from Bill's Donuts in Centerville, and they granted our first wish and sent a young boy who also was diagnosed with cancer to Disney World. And that's how it started. And today, a Special Wish Foundation, the Dayton chapter, we are the largest Special Wish chapter in the country. We grant roughly 55 wishes each year at an average cost of about $5,000 per wish.
And so let's talk about funding sources for Special Wish.
Our funding sources come from the community. A majority of our funding comes from individual donors who want to be part of helping this child who has had really a challenging situation laid upon them at such a young age to have an opportunity to do something fun, to get away from the doctors and from the hospitals, an opportunity for the child to be a kid again, as well as for the child to spend valuable time with their family. And we also are funded by the business community as well as grants from foundations.
So let's talk about some of the process for receiving help from the foundation.
If a child is diagnosed with a life-threatening illness, a parent, loved one, friend, family member can recommend that they receive a wish from us by going onto our website at aspecialwish.org or calling the foundation, which is 937-223-WISH, and filling out a referral form. Once we receive that referral form, we contact the child's primary care physician, and if the physician deems that the child has a life-threatening illness, then we begin that process. At a Special Wish, we do not make any determinations on a child's condition. That is all left up to the family's primary care physician. And once that's been approved, the child is asked what their three wishes are, and our goal is to grant one of those three wishes. We always try to get the first one, but sometimes things happen and we can't, or the situations come up that make a change, and we always make sure that we have opportunities for other wishes. And once a wish is chosen and agreed upon by the family, we go to work and make sure that that wish comes true. And in the 29 years we've been in existence, we have yet to say no to a child. We have granted every wish that's been asked of us. The only requirements that we have is the wish has to be in the continental United States, and it has to be age appropriate.
Did you say how many children you've served over the years?
We have just served just over 1,500 children since we were founded in 1983. Back in July, Owen, a young boy from Yellow Springs, Ohio, was our 1,500th wish, and we were fortunate enough to be able to arrange a meeting with Owen, with the President of the United States. So back in July, Owen went and spent time with President Barack Obama.
Let's talk about the impact that you see for these children and the families whose wishes are coming true.
Well, I think the impact is unmeasurable. I mean, we're giving an opportunity for hope. We're giving an opportunity of happiness. When a diagnosis comes through, and if anybody has healthy children, we're very, very fortunate. And we can only imagine what it would be like to have a child that's been diagnosed with a life-threatening illness. And what I like to say Special Wish does is we are the sunshine in the middle of a tornado. were an opportunity for the family to be a family again, to create really valuable memories for the family. And if it's a trip to get away, that, or if it is something else, they want to meet their favorite celebrity, they want to go to their favorite, say their favorite football game. You know, those are the wishes that we want to make sure the child has and has that opportunity to be really just to have those moments and create opportunity for the family to be together and to be a family.
Let's talk about some of the foundation's challenges. I'm sure we've talked about funding already. I'm sure that could be at the top of the list, as it is for most organizations.
Absolutely. Funding for the organization is our biggest challenge. Like I said, our average wish costs around $5,000. When we send out a family, we cover 100% of their expenses. We want this family, we understand that this family has gone through so much with medical bills and expenses. This is one less thing that we want to be a burden on. So we cover 100% of all expenses of the trip. So fundraising is very much important to us. It's a very much of a challenge. And some of the big challenges that we're facing right now is the increase in airfare. You know, we have seen a considerable jump in the cost of airfare over the past year. So that's a big challenge that we have. And besides that, most people are very, very gracious with our foundation. When we call and say, hey, we have a wish kid traveling, hotels, event parks, they're all very gracious in helping us with either free admission or reduced admission. I'm understanding that, you know, this is a very special circumstance for these children. And so that's our biggest challenge, obviously, is fundraising.
I want to jump back just a bit and talk a little bit more about the structure of the foundation, the overall scope. You said the headquarters is in Columbus?
Yes, and we have chapters throughout Ohio and throughout the country. The Special Wish Foundation is a smaller wish-granting national organization compared to the more popular one that most people get us confused with. Our structure is that we really are in the community. We're not regionally based. We are community based. And so a Special Wish has been the only wish organization in the Dayton area since 1983. And children living within our region are the ones that we are taking care of and making sure their wishes come true.
Are there any wishes that stand out as particularly unusual?
Well, we've had several. Well, obviously, meeting the President of the United States is an amazing wish, and we're very honored to be able to make sure that happened for Owen. Other wishes that have been really unique, we had a young girl who, at the end of her treatment, all she wanted to do was feel like a princess. And so we went in and did a complete room makeover for her and turned her bedroom into a castle. And so every night when she went to bed, she slept inside of a castle. We've had other wishes. We had a young boy this year who, when he was 2 years old, was diagnosed with a brain tumor. He's 4 years old now, and he spent the first couple of years of his life pretty much isolated because of germs and the doctors making sure that he was not susceptible to other illnesses. So his wish was for a clubhouse for him and all of his friends to play in. And so we were able to build a clubhouse this year. Just recently, we had a 15-year-old boy who was a huge Green Bay Packers fan, had the ultimate Green Bay Packer experience. We sent him up to Green Bay, local football fans will know that A.J. Hawk plays for the Packers, and he was instrumental in helping us make this wish come true. And Brett and his family got to spend the evening with A.J. and his wife. They went out to dinner. The Packers treated them to a tour of Lambeau Field. He got to go out on the field prior to the game against the Jaguars and throw some passes with the team. He got to meet his favorite players. And so, you know, it's exciting to see these kids that have gone through so much to have an opportunity to do something that they would never have the opportunity to do if it wasn't for a Special Wish Foundation. I say every day I'm so honored to be able to come to the office. It's not work. It's really amazing. And for the people that help us, we get calls all the time that are thanking us for allowing them to be part of a child's wish. Just to be able to see a child that has been through so much smile and laugh again. We hear back from parents all the time that while they were on their wish, it was the first time they had heard their child really laugh since the diagnosis. And, you know, and that's really a great feeling, knowing that we have a part in that.
David Sayer with a Special Wish Foundation. Thanks for speaking with us today.
Thank you very much.
Find out more about the foundation at aspecialwish.org.
Coming up next on WYSO, Bear Wright and Duart Headley attend McKinley Middle School in Yellow Springs. In this season of giving, these two young men are looking for a little help from our listeners.
Duart, you actually contacted us about a book collection for the people of Rwanda. So why don't you explain a little bit about that project?
Okay, so our school is collecting books and donations and boxes to ship the books in for the country of Rwanda. And we're doing this because a man came to our school from Rwanda. He was actually been a teacher there for the longest time. And he was telling us that Rwanda, well, it's a very small country in Africa and it doesn't have a lot of natural resources like the other countries in Africa do. So they've committed themselves to becoming an educated country. But to do this, they need books and they can't always afford those books. That's where we come in. We started a while back in like October, and we're going to continue on hopefully for a couple more months.
Okay, and how has your progress been so far?
We've gotten a lot of books and donations in, but we're trying to get the word out, which is the purpose of coming on air here and saying it. And it's just we really need people to know about this because publicity is the hardest thing for us right now.
And so tell me what struck you about this gentleman's message when he came to speak at your school.
Well, the man who came to our school was named Brother Stratton. He's pretty much like the principal / superintendent of the school there at Rwanda. The main thing that struck us about his visit was that when we were looking at Rwanda, when we saw it, we actually found out that they had a pretty nice school, but they didn't have a lot of educational books there. So that's like one of the main things that we were looking for book-wise.
Okay, so they kind of had the structure in place, but they don't really have the resources.
Yeah, they built a really, really nice library in the capital of Kigali. It's like a really, really nice library. They spent a lot of money on this. It's a nice building, but it's empty, and that's what we need books for. And all across Rwanda, there's not a lot of books, very, very limited number of books. So we're trying to help them out by collecting them and shipping them to them.
You mentioned that this has been going on for a couple of months. Have you made any shipments over there yet?
Not quite yet. We have a group of students assigned to working on shipping, contacting the shipping companies and getting the boxes and whatnot. I think we're going to wait till the end of our project and then gather all our books and send them in shipments as much as we can.
And so what is the process that people need to do to donate?
Well, we have boxes and donation bins in our actual school out front of the office or in the hallways, and they'll be labeled Book Drive for Rwanda. And you could also call our teacher and contact her and ask her about like when you could bring them in or how you could bring them in. And her number is, if you want to contact her, it's 937-829-7696 if you would like to call her and donate.
Okay, and what's her name?
Miss Blake, Aurelia Blake.
Okay, and anything else we should know about the project?
Well, we don't just need educational books or library books. Another thing that they're looking for, they open up a nursery for the children.
Mm-hmm.
So they also need a lot of children's books because that is also empty book-wise.
And we ask not too much like teen fiction or young adult fiction like The Hunger Games and stuff like that. If possible, we would like educational books and children's books.
Are you looking for more than books, you said?
Yes, any kind of thing helps. We have books or money. You can even donate your boxes to ship the books in because we're also collecting those. So that'd be very, very nice. Anything you can give helps.
Well, thank you both for joining us, and we hope that this gets you a little bit farther down the road with your collections.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm Jerry Kenny. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO. Thanks so much for joining us this Sunday morning. Maureen Berry and Kit Laurie are both directors on the board of a new entity in Dayton, the 5th Street Brew Pub. The new co-op underway has many people excited, and so let's say our next segment is about building wishes from wasted spaces. First, co-founder Maureen Berry answers the question, what is a co-op?
A co-op is a very unique business model, and as an entity, it's very democratic. So it's one member, one vote. So anyone who joins has an equal vote and say in who is elected on the board of directors, voting on bylaws and other important, really big picture decisions. But really the board sort of controls the big picture end goal kind of decisions. And then eventually we'll hire a staff, a general manager and staff that run the daily operations.
So the co-op is essentially buying a share into the business.
Correct. So every member who purchases a membership is an equal owner of the business. No one owns any more or less than anyone else. Another important part of membership is that you do get a return on your investment, so to speak. I mean, that's not really what it's about, but it does, as a co-op, an entity, it can't hold a profit. So the profit either has to be redistributed back into the business to make capital improvements or other ways to grow the business. And then once all of that's taken care of after the first couple of years, we'll probably start offering a patronage refund to all the members. So the profit is then distributed among the member owners. And it's based on patronage. So the more you use the co-op, the more you get back.
Okay, so that's the business model mm-hmm. side of it. Yeah. Let's talk about what will actually take place here, which is a brewery.
Right. So we will brew our own beer. We have a brewmaster. His name's Eric Zamonsky. He was trained at University of California at Davis, where they have one of the only, I think, only two programs in the country. So he is local here at Dayton. He lives in Oakwood, I believe, presently. And he signed on to be our brewmaster. But we will also have a homebrew program where people can come and brew on our pilot system if they are a member owner. So a lot of the homebrew community are very excited about that possibility. And then eventually we'll also be a restaurant. We're going to open in phases, and that will sort of be phase three is the food part, because we feel like the brewing is what people sort of signed on for, so that will be priority. And the brewing equipment is pretty expensive. It's like $135,000 or something like that. So, and we hope to be able to pay for everything through membership and investment from our member owners. There have been investment packages along the way, too. So we hope not to take any bank loans and to just pay for everything through our own and say that we're the brew pub that Dayton built.
And how's the response so far?
The response has been overwhelmingly positive. We had quite a busy summer. We had like a charter membership deadline of July 31st just to sort of gauge interest. We blew our goal out of the water. We wanted 300, but we got 850 before July 31st. And since then, it's steady. So we need 2,000 members. We're at about 1,150 right now. So if we get 2,000, we'll be able to pay for everything through membership.
And Kit, as someone new to the board, what interested you about this project?
Well, it was a combination of a couple things that really drew my interest based on things that I enjoy and things that I value. And one, locally brewed craft beer is certainly something I enjoy. And secondly, having a establishment that is fun and welcoming to the community would be another piece of what really interests me as being the brew pub. But thirdly, it's that this is a project that involves the community, that being a member, that means that you're one of the owners, and so that you can really participate in making this project happen. And I think what's important about this project is that it's really contributing to the ongoing effort to revitalize this area and this neighborhood. And it contributes to the larger urban renewal and economic growth that Dayton and the Miami Valley is working so hard to achieve. So to me, it just brings together the things that, again, that I enjoy and that I really value.
And so we're at 1600 East 5th Street in St. Anne's Hill, so folks can drive by and take a look at the work in progress and know that there's going to be a brewery inside the building with lots of potential. You have an event coming up, and let's talk about that.
Yeah, we have a sneak peek open house party on December 22nd, Saturday. It will be open from noon to 8 that day, so you can just drop in whenever you have time. You can take a tour, look around, see our progress, possibly join if you're so inclined. It'll also benefit Toys for Tots, so we will be making some cash donations. People don't have to bring toys, but we'll be making a cash donation since it's so close to the holiday itself. They probably already have all the toys lined up by then. So we'll have music and hors d'oeuvres and just a chance to see the progress and the construction so far.
And you have a website with more information, and people can take a look at what's going on here?
Yes, it's 5th Street, all spelled out, FIFTHSTREET.coop, COOP. And from there, you can sort of learn more about the membership benefits and also purchase a gift membership for the holiday or a membership for yourself, and also learn a little bit about our story and what's been going on so far.
And I think we should say that memberships are $100, a one-time membership fee. And again, that enables you to say that you own this brew pub, along with we're hoping for up to 2,000 members. And we certainly hope to bring on a lot of members during this holiday period, both as gifts and if it's something that you'd like for yourself.
With 1,100, you're well underway there.
Yes, yeah. I think we've been making steady progress, and I think we have a very nice holiday promotion that it can be a great gift to give someone that is either, you know, a craft beer enthusiast or that really just cares about making this community come alive and be strong.
Kit, Maureen, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Again, you can find out about memberships and upcoming events at fifthstreet.coop and find out more about the backstory on the Fifth Street Brew Pub when our reinvention series launches in January. Find out more about that on our website at wyso.org. On New Year's Day, WYSO will bring you a special presentation of speeches from the writers honored with the 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize. Starting this week, we'll give you a preview of some of those speeches. Today, we'll hear from Anya Cizadlo, the nonfiction runner-up for her book, Day of Honey. Cizadlo is a journalist covering culture, politics, and the Middle East, including the Iraq War.
Somebody asked us a question last night, and I've been thinking about it ever since. It's a very old question. We've all heard it before, and it's never really been answered. It was simply this question: we all believe that war is bad. You're not going to find someone who's going to tell you, you know, war is really great. I really like it. It's really cool. I think we should do more of it. And you will be hard-pressed to find people who will say that it's good, and yet we keep doing it. We keep saying that it's necessary over and over again. So is this something that we're simply predisposed to do? Are we made to do this the way that a saber-toothed tiger is made to kill and eat gazelles? Are we hardwired? Are we designed for this? And the way he said it, I thought was interesting. He said, you know, is this just the way these people are? Which I thought was interesting, because we always think it's always someone else who starts it, right? And we just have to come in and fix it, because we're good, you know, we're going to fix it by coming in and joining in. And it made me think about my own career, particularly before I wrote this book, which was as a journalist and covering the Iraq War, which is actually something that I love doing. And I loved being a war correspondent, but one of the drawbacks to that, which is, you know, a big occupational hazard, particularly covering a war like the Iraq War, you are constantly selling stories about war. And particularly as a freelancer, you're really hustling, you're really selling. And this means that you, on some level, are selling war, or at least that's what you worry. That's something that you think about. It's kind of constantly haunting you. If I'm selling stories about war, am I helping to sell war? I'll give you an example. Back in 2005, I wrote a magazine profile of a human rights lawyer and a democracy activist in Beirut who was running this guerrilla presidential campaign. And he was using social media, and he was doing all kinds of really cool stuff. He'd gone to the local transparency sort of anti-corruption NGO, and he'd actually voluntarily said, can you monitor my campaign finances? Mm-hmm. I mean, imagine a politician anywhere doing this. It was unheard of in Lebanon. It would be unheard of here. And it was exactly the kind of creative and provocative and intelligent activism that we never really get to hear about in the U.S. or only rarely get to hear about. And this was a risky thing, by the way. Activists like him were getting assassinated right and left in those days. And so I thought he'd be a really cool subject for a profile. He was a fascinating figure to me because he was an anti-war activist, but also a war activist. He had been very much a proponent of the Iraq War because he had been, a big supporter of the Kurdish independence movement and a big supporter of the anti-Saddam movement for very, very many years, going back to the time when the United States was a big supporter of Saddam. So he was a fascinating character for that reason. He was a really, really fascinating character of a sort of an anti-war warmonger. And I thought it was really interesting that he was running this presidential campaign. I thought readers like you would be interested in reading about him. So I convinced this magazine to assign a profile of him, and I wrote it, and they ended up killing it because he wasn't important enough. Not that I'm bitter. And they emailed me and they said, you know, sorry, it's a great, he's really interesting, but he's just not important. He's not a player. And they asked me to do yet another article about Hezbollah instead. And this is something, this is the kind of decision that editors make every day. This is what shapes what you all get to read. So I was complaining to a friend of mine about this, another journalist, and she laughed and she said something I've never forgotten. She said, look, the problem with him is he hasn't killed anybody. Let him kill a few people, just one or two, nothing fancy, you know, and they'll be interested. And we both laughed kind of, you know, cynically, but she was right. And we both knew she was right. You can always tell a story about a militia leader or a soldier or, better yet, a general. I mean, everyone wants to read about a general. How often do you hear about a human rights lawyer or an interview with a disaster relief specialist, a Q&A with a hunger striker or a refugee? You hear those stories, but they're very rare, very, very rare. One of the most fascinating stories I ever did was about a guy who ran away from a war. He was an Iraqi, and he became a refugee because the guys in his village wanted him to join the Mahdi army, and he didn't really feel like joining the Mahdi army that day or any day. So after a couple weeks of pressure, they came to his house and they shot him, and a huge exit wound. I mean, he almost died. So he ended up going to Lebanon and becoming a refugee. He risked death in order not to participate in a war. What kind of courage does that take? I mean, my God. Courage to not be in a war, we don't really hear so much about that. And I met dozens of guys like him in Iraq and in Lebanon, people who simply refused, who said no, people who were beaten, shot, kidnapped, and worse because they refused to be a part of a war. There were thousands of guys like that. There are thousands of guys like that in every war zone, guys and women. Refugee camps are full of people like this, people who have that kind of individual courage. And you hardly ever hear their stories. They're very hard for people like me to sell, and they're consequently harder for people like you to read. And I believe that you guys actually want to read those stories. I do think that you want to hear those stories. And this gets back to that guy's question from last night. I can't really answer the fundamental question about human nature, like whether we're inherently violent or not. It's above my pay grade. But I do know this, and I said this last night, and I'll say it again. War is something that has to be taught. It has to be very methodically and systematically taught. Violence, yeah, we all have that in us, even me, even you. But war is different. War is not simply violence. War is very methodical. It takes a long time to build. It can break out in an instant, but the preparation has usually lasted for months. And many people participate in this teaching and this preparation. And I think that if we can teach it, this should seem obvious, right? Then we can unteach it. If we can learn it, we can unlearn it. We have books that teach war. We have Sun Tzu, Machiavelli training manuals. We have a great machine and system for teaching war. And even the media is part of it. I'm part of it as part of the media. But we also have all these books that unteach it, right? That teach us about avoiding it or stopping it. And that's why I'm so grateful for this prize. I'm grateful just that it exists. Because we, writers, authors, journalists, we don't necessarily get that much encouragement for the unteaching of war. It's important to remember writing about the war against war. This is part of writing about war as well. Stories are out there. There are, like I said, thousands of people out there, not just in the Middle East, but from places from Africa to Afghanistan. People are fighting against war every day. I do think that you readers love to hear those stories, and I love telling them. I can't claim that I've stopped any bullets with my book, although it's certainly thick enough, probably. I don't know if we're stopping any wars just by being here. No, we're not starting one, at least not while we're here. That's nothing to sneer at. And I think that that's something that we can learn by example. We can learn from stories of people like this. These people like these Iraqis that I'm talking about, people like I said, refugee camps are full of. And if we can learn about people who had the bravery to risk their lives to avoid a war, maybe that will help us answer this question. Is this the way we are? Yeah, it is part of the way we are. We do keep having wars. But it's also in our nature to disobey, to say no. What is it? Oscar Wilde, I think, said disobedience is man's original virtue. It is in our nature to say no. no, screw this. I'm not going to do it. Sorry. You can shoot me. You can kick me. You can burn me. You can beat me. But I am not going to do this. This is wrong. This is bad. And I applaud that spirit. And I thank you again for this prize. Thanks.
Anya Cizadlo, one of the writers honored this year with a 2012 Dayton Literary Peace Prize. Join us next week for another selection and our special presentation of selections on New Year's Day. That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks to all our guests, and thank you for listening to member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at WYSO.org, a broadcast service of Antioch University for the Miami Valley. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Book.